Hello and welcome to Health Affairs This Week. I'm your host, Jeff Byers. Today we'll be talking about the ACA marketplace and how it's matured over a decade. But first, I want to direct everyone to an ahead of print article from Health Affairs that we published last week. The article will appear in our May issue, but you can read it online now. It's called The Impact of Telemedicine on Medicare Utilization, Spending, and Quality, 2019 to 2022 by Carter Nakamoto and colleagues. Check out the link in the show notes to see how telehealth was utilized during the COVID-19 pandemic. And now, let's talk about the individual marketplace. Today, we have Sabrina Corlett from Georgetown University and Jason Levitas from Urban Institute. Sabrina and Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
So let's contextualize the ACA market or the individual market first before we dive into what you all wrote on Health Affairs Forefront recently about transparency and standardization of the market. So how big is this individual market and how does it compare to other forms of coverage?
Yeah, Jeff, first of all, thank you for having us. It's really a delight to be with you today. So the Affordable Care Act marketplace has expanded quite a bit in the last few years. In 2020, there are a little over 10 million people enrolled in the marketplace, and we're now in 2024 at over 20 million. So it's an all-time high for the marketplace, and that's largely due to major investments made by the Biden administration in the ACA. Including increasing premium subsidies and boosting outreach and consumer assistance. Now, when you put it into context, marketplace enrollment, even at 20 plus million, is still much smaller than other forms of coverage. So we have about, today we have about 80 to 85 million people in Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, about 65 million in Medicare. And the big kahuna, employer-sponsored insurance, we have about 150 million people enrolled in that. So the ACA marketplaces are relatively small, but I think it's important to keep in mind that they are a really critical safety net for people who are between jobs or self-employed, or for some reason are working, but their employer just doesn't offer them insurance. And thanks to the ACA, the number of people who are uninsured is at an all-time low. It's about half of what it was in 2010 when the ACA was enacted. Overall, we can say the Affordable Care Act marketplaces have really become a key safety net for people.
Yeah, former customer myself. Just to put a number on it, do you have a percentage? I could try to do some quick calculations, but what's the percentage of the individual market in the total market?
Jeff, you're asking the wrong person. I went to law school because there's no math on the LSAT. I'd have to like do some number crunching, but I don't have that number offhand. Jason, do you know?
I mean, what if it's 20 million out of 330 million, you know, then that's something like 6%.
The listener will tell us if we're wrong or right. So let us know. So you both recently wrote in Health Affairs Forefront about how the federal government is pushing for more standardization and transparency in this market. For those that may have not been keeping up, how has the ACA marketplace been maturing to date?
I had the honor of being part of the team that stood up the ACA during the Obama years. And it is no secret, I say this with all love, that it got off to a bit of a rocky start. And then there was also some turbulence during the Trump years. But I would say that now the ACA, the marketplaces, are in a bit of a golden age. So for several years, the market has been mature and stable. IT systems working, premiums pretty stable, insurer participation adequate and stable. And with all of that in place, we've been seeing sort of a flowering of innovation recently at both the federal and state levels. Experimentation with things like facilitated enrollment, better integration with Medicaid to smooth those coverage transitions, the increased federal subsidies that Sabrina referred to, and then also subsidies at the state level. working on efforts to extend coverage in some states to undocumented people. And this is all playing out in the historically higher enrollment numbers that Sabrina mentioned.
So the website does work, is what you're saying.
The website works, yes. Exactly right.
And so what are these new standards looking to achieve in the grand sense?
It's a number of things. And, you know, I think taking a step back, it's important to recognize that we are, you know, 3 years in to the Biden administration working on the ACA. To some extent, we're in cleanup time now, right? I mean, you know, this is where we're at the end. And so a lot has been done, but there are some important things here. And I guess I would highlight like two main things. First of all, there is a big focus in here on standards for state-based marketplaces. So background for your listeners, right? You can each state can either use the federal marketplace or have a state marketplace. There have not up until now been clear, strong standards for state marketplaces. So this does that. And then there's additional work continuing with the Biden administration priority since the beginning to support coverage, reduce administrative burdens, and address disparities in healthcare and health coverage.
I think it's important to observe that, you know, while the Biden administration still has, you know, some rulemaking to do, this could be sort of the penultimate statement that they're making on the marketplaces in the fourth year of his term. And it's just, you know, when I look back and at, you know, we had 4 years under the Trump administration of really systematic efforts to unwind or reverse a lot of the Affordable Care Act. The Biden administration, he certainly campaigned on this, but he committed to building on and strengthening the ACA. And I see this latest set of standards and rules as really the, you know, final stamp, or hopefully not final, but the culmination of a number of efforts by the Biden administration to make the ACA work for people, make the coverage more affordable and accessible.
So looking at this final notice, this can affect insurers, this can affect patients, it can affect states. We'll try to get to them all. How might these new standards and requirements affect insurers?
So there are a number of standards that really try to raise the bar for insurance companies. For example, network adequacy. To be a plan in the marketplace, you have to have what they call an adequate network of providers that can meet consumers' needs. And under these rules, in all states, both state-run marketplaces and the federally run marketplace, insurers are going to have to meet objective standards for what it means for consumers to have access to providers. For the carriers, that means they might have to contract with more doctors and hospitals and in turn pay them higher reimbursement rates to incentivize them to participate. Another big area that I think the insurance companies are going to be watching is essential health benefits. This is sort of the minimum set of benefits they have to cover in their plans. You know, if the past is any guide, states are likely to use some of the new flexibilities that are in this rule to expand the number of benefits that carriers have to cover. And of course, insurance companies are saying, well, if I have to expand the number of benefits I cover, that's going to increase premiums. So we'll see. Another big issue is that the final rule opens the door for states to add adult dental benefits, which, you know, for a lot of adults, that's huge, right? And I think insurance companies are concerned not just about the costs of having to do that, but what it would mean for them to have to build a network of dental providers, which some of them are not used to doing.
Yeah, that relates to another question that I had, where having the carriers now have to figure out the network of dental providers, that's probably some administrative work, some new workflows and processes that they have to figure out. It also made me think about, from a state perspective, you know, what might the administrative burden or administrative activity be for this final notice?
So maybe the biggest grouping of new rules in this regulation is rules for state-based marketplaces. Both what they have to do and the process that states have to go through to establish a state-based marketplace. You know, the interesting thing is that there are all these new rules, but for almost all of the rules, every one of the state-based marketplaces, there are, you know, about 20 of them out there right now, already follows the rule, right? So the new rules say state-based marketplaces have to determine eligibility. They all do that. They have to keep track of who's enrolled. They have to have a call center. So these rules are not intended to correct a problem that's out there. Why impose these new rules? And I think what's going on actually is they're sort of their prophylaxis. And the reason is that Georgia had proposed a few years back as part of a 1332 waiver to get rid of the federal marketplace and basically rely on private web brokers instead of having a marketplace. So there wouldn't necessarily be a single place where consumers could go and compare all plans sort of fairly. And of course, that would have undermined a key goal of the ACA. And I think there's a concern that a state could try to do that with the state-based marketplace, or there could have without these new standards. And so a lot of what CMS is doing here is just clarifying, you know, you can't do that. If you're going to say you have a state-based marketplace, you have to do all these functions. With that said, there is one exception, the really important exception of network adequacy.
That's an issue that a number of states are going to have to figure out. Do they have network adequacy standards that are at least as stringent as the federal standards? And how are they going to be doing the oversight and enforcement of that? This rule lays out some new requirements for states that some may be fine. They may be meeting those standards already and doing very robust oversight. And others, they're going to have to get their acts together and do a lot more on network adequacy. The other big issue for states is trying to decide whether they want to pursue changes to essential health benefits. You know, we've seen a number of states in recent years add new benefits to the minimum required. And these new rules kind of give states new flexibilities, new opportunities to potentially expand that benefit package. But it's all optional for states. They need to figure out if they want to do that.
And then looking at the patient side, are there any downmarket effects that these requirements might create?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've already talked a little bit about network adequacy, but as you may know, Jeff, one of the biggest complaints that people have about the marketplace health plans is they have these narrow provider networks, particularly when you compare them to employer-based insurance. So I do think that the new requirements around network adequacy, and these include like maximum amount of time that somebody might have to travel to see a doctor or amount of time that they have to wait for a doctor appointment. Those should have effects for patients who are trying to get in to see a doctor. The other one that I'm, you know, I'll be really interested to see how many states try to add adult dental benefits. As you know, a lot of people that's a critical service that they just don't have access to because they don't have the coverage for it.
The other set of things in here that could have an important impact on consumers, on patients, is a range of things continuing with the Biden administration focus on reducing administrative burdens and helping people keep coverage. So there's this rule in there that says that marketplaces no longer need to ping a national database of who might be incarcerated, which they found was stopping people from getting coverage who really weren't incarcerated and not actually keeping out people who shouldn't be eligible. There are rules in there to make it easier for more people to get automatically re-enrolled if they don't come back each year. There are rules in there to make sure people who could lose subsidies are notified. And there's a rule in there making permanent a special enrollment period for some low-income consumers. So just sort of a range of things like that that are going to help people get covered or stay covered.
Well, the administration noted that it's trying to increase transparency, advance health equity, and mitigate health disparities. How do these standards work towards this? And are there any other policies that CMS is pursuing to connect these goals?
This rule and several of the administrative actions that the Biden administration has taken are really part of his sort of bigger picture effort to build on the Affordable Care Act and make it work for more people. So with the enhanced premium tax credits and the fixes to what we call the family glitch that make it harder, that did make it harder for people with unaffordable employer coverage to get subsidies. There's just a litany of things that the Biden administration has done in the last 3+ years to make marketplace coverage more affordable, more accessible, and make the coverage itself a better value for consumers. So this rule sort of stands with a whole suite of policies that the Biden administration has tried to pursue to achieve those goals. You know, I would sort of say it's important to sort of see it in that context.
Well, Sabrina and Jason, thanks for joining me on Health Affairs this week. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review, tell a friend, shout it from the rooftops. Thanks. Have a good one.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.